This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Bert Running Water is the director of the Native American and Indigenous Program at Sundance Institute. Born and raised on the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico, Bert was in Malaysia recently to judge the Borneo Eco Film Festival. BFM's Tra and Tech caught up with him for a conversation about Native filmmaking, its history, and the politics of representing Indigenous communities in the media.
But thank you for joining us. You have degrees in journalism and Native American studies from the University of Oklahoma and a master's in public affairs from the University of Texas at Austin's Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs. You are someone who has obviously given a lot of thought to Native American rights and the ethics of its representation. Perhaps we can start by having you tell us a little bit about your childhood and how you became politically awakened.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you. I have some of my earliest memories of representation kind of stem from my childhood of growing up on the Mescalero Apache Reservation. And when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I remember when satellite television and VCRs and video game units first came to our community, and how all of a sudden, you know, attention was redirected from the core of our community, which was culture and language and ritual, and that became distracted by what was happening on the television screen. And so, you know, my father used to take me to movies as a child, and we used to go and watch movies like Rocky and The Deer Hunter and, you know, Rocky II, Rocky III, all of those big, you know, Hollywood films. And I always recognize, you know, that there was little representation of who I was or who the world that I came from, except for one film that came about that I remember going to watch with my mother, and it was called Wind Walker. And it was an old film made probably like late 70s, early 80s, that was a period piece drama film that was told and made in the Cheyenne language, which is my mother's language. And that was one of the first times that I kind of saw like this idea of representation, and even though it was a story of a period piece happening in the past, there was something interesting there. So, you know, I carried on through my education. When I got to university, I had always loved to write. I was always telling stories through my own writing, and so that's why I majored in journalism, and I became a journalist for the university paper. And I used to write a weekly column, you know, kind of presenting the Native perspective, which was very absent from that publication until I came along. And I started to recognize the potential for presenting, you know, a Native perspective, but also kind of that there could be particular kinds of, like you would say, maybe backlash against presenting a Native perspective within, you know, that journalistic context. And so, you know, I recognized, you know, it was empowering, it had benefits, you know, there were definitely bad things that came about of it, and it just kind of kept inspiring me to kind of stay engaged in this idea of first-person perspective, what could be presented from an Indigenous community to a public that a lot of times didn't know that we existed. Or sometimes in the notion of where I went to college in Oklahoma, there's a particular tension between the Native community and the non-Native community, and a lot of kind of underlying racism that kind of existed within that region. Sometimes a lot of the stories that I was writing or the perspective that I was presenting in my column created a lot of friction and backlash against me personally. So I felt like there was always something there. You know, and I ended up going to grad school, studying policy. I got a job working for the Ford Foundation where I funded radio, TV, film projects that were intended for public broadcast, whether in the U.S. or countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, Russia. And I always had the opportunity to support Indigenous film projects and Indigenous film organizations. But at that point, within the kind of national Native American film community, we were still fledgling. We had been making some documentaries in the community. People really aspired to make fiction films, And, you know, I entered the native media world at that point when the idea from our community existed that we weren't quite sure that we could make fiction feature films. And thankfully, in 1998, we did, and we started making them, and we're still making them today, and they're getting better and better and being seen by broader and broader audiences.
I want to come back to that 1998 film, but just to pursue a little bit further on the friction that you mentioned that exists between the native and non-native community. This, I guess, is a build-up or accumulation of the history of U.S. government policy towards Native Americans, that is of assimilation that is sometimes willing but often violent. How would you describe the relationship between the federal government and the sovereign nations today within its borders?
You know, it's a very unique relationship that exists in the United States. And I feel like there's a lot of positivities that come out of it in terms of how we are recognized as sovereign nations. And a lot of that history goes back to the early days of the points of contact between the French and the tribes in the northeastern, what's now known as the northeastern United States, and, you know, the British and their, you know, contact with Native people, where they entered into treaty-making processes that then the United States kind of began observing that political process of entering into treaties and negotiating with Indian tribes. And so because our land was sometimes bought, sometimes stolen, you know, overtaken, you know, there are always these negotiations and processes that always referred back to treaties and treaty rights that were made between, you know, distinct sovereignties. And so that really serves as a basis for a whole canon of American law. You know, there's a whole area called Indian law, which is really built upon early treaty rights, some early Supreme Court decisions known as the Marshall Trilogy, which really started to provide a basis and foundation for defining, you know, American Indian tribes as domestic dependent nations and quasi-sovereign entities, and really laying the groundwork for today, where, you know, we're still going constant negotiations with the American government, you know, to uphold treaty rights, to uphold, you know, our own sovereign rights to be self-governing, to be self-determining, and for us to kind of be, I guess, having kind of control over our own future and our own destiny, and to try to create and maintain, you know, a better life for the citizens of our tribal nations.
How much does the trial of Leonard Peltier lingers in the background or foreground when talking about Native American rights today?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a constant point of discussion and a constant point of activism that a lot of not only Native American people but non-Native people in the U.S. are constantly advocating for, you know, and that his imprisonment, and it really goes back to a point in time in the 1970s when there was a really coming out of the 60s era of activism amongst a lot of other communities, you know, the Black Panthers and the African American community, you know, and the Brown Berets within the Mexican American community. And so, you know, we had the Red Power movement, which was really kind of like an awakening of social activism, where Indian tribes, you know, it was kind of informed by a political era within United States governance policy where Indian tribes weren't self-governing. We didn't have, you know, the tools to be self-determining, you know, coming out of the 60s. And it wasn't until the 70s, and because of activism like Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement and people who were working externally as activists and advocates, but also, you know, there were people internally within the government system, like people like LaDonna Harris, who's Comanche, who was married to, you know, a United States senator from Oklahoma. You know, and Oklahoma has one of the highest populations of Native tribes. So there was such a collective effort in the 60s and those early 70s era to reach this point of where Richard Nixon, our president at the time, declared an end of the era of termination of Indian tribes and declared an era of self-determination. So from then forward, all the governance policy of dealing with Indian tribes was to help empower them to be self-determining. And Leonard Peltier really serves as an icon of that very historic moment where there were people who stood up, you know, for our Native communities, and who, you know, have gone to prison and sometimes have died, you know, fighting for the rights of Native people, for us to be self-determining and to, you know, maintain our cultures and language. And so, you know, Peltier really serves as an icon of that era. And, you know, and he's been imprisoned now for, you know, almost more than 40 years. And there are a lot of people who are still feel that he was wrongfully imprisoned, and that, you know, there was a particular agenda behind his imprisonment. But there's still a lot of people who are working to try to free him today.
That was Bird Runningwater of the Sundance Institute speaking to BFM's Chua and Tech. More about Bird's role as the Director of Native American and Indigenous Program after the break. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. And on the show today is Bird Runningwater. Before the break, he was chatting with Chua and Tech about the lack of Indigenous issue coverage in American mainstream media. And now he's going to explain how he intends to rectify this in his capacity as the Director of Native American and Indigenous Programs at the Sundance Institute.
You are today the Director of the Sundance Institute Native American and Indigenous Program. You are someone who have done very well in mainstream society. What is your role at Sundance, and how do you support Native American filmmakers?
Yeah, well, you know, I first connected with Sundance Institute when I was working in New York City at the Ford Foundation, doing, you know, global works, you know, funding film and media, and I attended Sundance Film Festival in 1998, representing the Ford Foundation, and I just happened to be there the year that Smoke Signals premiered, and that was our first feature film written, produced, and directed by Native Americans. And like I mentioned, you know, I entered our media world back at a time when the idea of making feature films was a hope, you know, it was an aspiration. And we as a community were really trying to figure out, we knew we had the talent, we knew we had the ability, but we were really trying to put together all the pieces to figure out, can we actually make feature films, and can we actually make films that will get seen by the broadest audience possible? And so I happened to be there, and so I stayed in touch with Sundance after I attended that festival. I found out they had an Indigenous program. At the time, the director, her name was Heather Ray, and I would read scripts for her. I would help give her commentary in her process. And after I left Ford, I went to work for another foundation. I was an executive director there, funding language programs across our country. And then there was an opening at Sundance Institute to work with this Indigenous program. So I took that opportunity to do that and have been there for 15 years, helping to develop programs that nurture and support our filmmakers. And one of the things that, you know, that the Indigenous program at Sundance has always aspired to do, thanks to our founder, Robert Redford, is to really support Native filmmakers to create our own authentic stories from our perspective, whether they're feature, documentary, short film. And at the time when I came into Sundance, there was still a struggle to create, I think, effective programs that were actually creating and supporting and having an output of films. And so I've been very lucky to design some really great programs that have supported some of our most iconic filmmakers now that are working today. And we've taken the program to be an international program, so we work globally with Indigenous filmmakers. That's one of the exciting reasons why I'm here in Malaysia, is to start to pay attention to, you know, the emerging Indigenous film community that's happening in Malaysia, and hoping to bring them into the fold of our, you know, Indigenous film circle. So my job is really to scout for new and exciting filmmakers who have scripts and projects and ideas that Sundance could potentially get behind. I'm also looking for finished films that could be taken as submitted to our film festival and considered for festival screening opportunities. And, you know, and really trying to connect a lot of the communities that we work with, that I work with specifically, in Aboriginal communities in Canada, the Maori community in New Zealand, Indigenous filmmakers in Australia. You know, and last year we showed a Greenlandic Inuit animated short film. We showed our first Sami short film from the Arctic Circle of the Scandinavian countries. You know, so there's a large and growing international indigenous filmmaking community that is creating some really exciting work, and a lot of it is being brought together and being presented and shared on a global scale by my program.
You alluded earlier many times to the moment in 1998 when you saw the film Smoke Signals and how all the puzzle pieces came together. And I was wondering if, in your role as an advocate for Native filmmaking, do you think filmmakers have a responsibility to highlight the social issues affecting their communities?
I do, yes, I do think that. I think there's a lot of responsibility that comes with being an Indigenous filmmaker. I think that, you know, definitely social justice and socio-political issues will always be a part of our storytelling, just based upon, you know, a lot of the different countries where a lot of our communities exist have dealt with, you know, a lot of historical processes, whether they're, colonization or, you know, displacement, you know, and even kind of cultural issues like loss of language and dealing with, you know, maintaining, you know, a whole identity as an Indigenous person in a constantly globalizing world. And so I think the responsibilities of an Indigenous filmmaker are always about continuing to really represent an authentic sense of humanity, really, coming from an Indigenous perspective. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of the cultural components of life that we have, that we still practice on a daily basis, continually connect us to a sense of place, to our world, to the earth that we walk on, and a lot of the world and a lot of the conflict that seems to be happening on a global scale is really a lot about a loss of connection and a loss of a sense of humanity, you know? And so I feel like our Indigenous filmmakers are the most primed to really tell, like, some of the most really interesting and complex narratives of a human experience that somebody can be inspired by, that you can keep moving forward and being connected to your earth, to your language, to your community, and yet still live and exist in a global society and flourish. And, you know, there's not many people who can do that. And that's why I feel like there's so much conflict, because people are struggling to figure out who they are, you know, in a global sense, and they don't know where they come from. And so, you know, there's a lot of conflict happening in the world. But I think that Indigenous filmmakers and Indigenous people can really lend something to the larger sense of humanity.
You've judged films from all over the world as you're here in Malaysia to attend at the Borneo Eco Film Festival. And I was wondering if you see a pattern or a uniformity in the struggle or challenges faced by Native filmmakers in telling their stories.
Yeah, well, one of the things I observed with a lot of the Indigenous filmmakers I interacted with in Sabah was, you know, there's still a kind of a fledgling community, you know. The community is kind of in a place where our community was maybe 20 years ago, and you know, but at the same time, you know, the coordinators and the people who run the Echo Film Festival are doing labs and workshops and really creating a pipeline of training young filmmakers and giving them the tools and the knowledge to understand how to, you know, tell cinematic stories. And so I saw one level of people who were just being introduced to storytelling for the screen, who were given certain exercises, and their films were screened at the festival. And then there's kind of like a returning age group of people who have gone through the initial training and now have advanced to a different level and are out collecting stories and trying to tell larger stories and coming there for follow-up workshops for editing and shaping of story, and their films were screened at the festival. So And so my role with that festival was I brought in indigenous short films to screen from some of our, you know, American Indian filmmakers, Canadian Aboriginal filmmakers, to screen for not only these young people who are learning the craft to make films, but also the audiences in general. And that kind of cross-pollination, I think, is really great, because those younger, emerging filmmakers who are just entering the scene and trying to learn the tools and really have, you know, great stories to tell, for them, I think, to see other indigenous films from different parts of the world and people who have struggled to get to a certain point of telling their stories as well. And I think that there's familiarity there and lessons that can be learned. And so I think there's great hope in not only those filmmakers, but, you know, some of the other aspiring filmmaking groups that I've interacted with on my travels here now in Kuching and then traveling on to Kuala Lumpur tomorrow. And so it's been a really rich and inspiring trip. I just hope that I've contributed something to the dialogue.
What do you look for nowadays in the projects or the scripts that come through your desk beyond beyond the native way of filmmaking that you elaborated just now, as well as beyond social justice?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know what? That's so funny. That's the number one question I keep getting asked. And you know that there's not, I mean, if I had to be reductive about it, and if I had to say that there's one thing, which I hate saying, that there's one thing that I look for, but if there's one thing that not only I look for, that my colleagues look for at Sundance, is really an authentic voice. An authentic voice in film that is using the craft of screenwriting or the craft of filmmaking, the craft of directing, to really articulate and share, you know, a unique story, a distinct story that is something that maybe a world that I've never been into, but that I can be taken on a journey through while reading a script, and, you know, through really great writing, who can introduce me to characters that maybe I might see some of myself in, or I might see some of my family members in, but that even though there's that familiarity, it's happening in a completely different world, and, you know, and then another world that I may not have been to, and I can be taken on a journey, and that I can grow a little bit myself emotionally or spiritually after experiencing this journey of a great story that's being told in a script.
Before I let you go, maybe you can give us one or maybe two film recommendation.
You're asking me to be reductive again.
It's the nature of the format, I'm sorry.
I'm just kidding. Well, I mean, there's so many great filmmakers out there that I've been able to work with who are making great work, but one of the ones that I highlighted today in my talks here in Kuching is a Creek Seminole filmmaker named Sterling Harjo, who has a really great body of work. You know, we started working with him on his first feature called Four Sheets to the Wind, but he has a new feature called Miko, M-E-K-K-O, that just played at the Toronto International Film Festival. And then, you know, there's also the work of Taika Waititi, who's a Maori filmmaker out of New Zealand, who, you know, made a very beautiful little black and white short film 10 years ago called Two Cars, One Night, that got nominated for an Oscar, his first time ever making a short film. And then he adapted parts of that story to create a feature film called Boy, which became New Zealand's, you know, highest grossing homemade film of all time about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Thank you very much, Britt.
That was Bird Running Water of the Sundance Institute speaking to BFM's Tran Tech on today's Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.